An Emirates 777 is landing in Dubai when they decide to go around. What caused this flight's go-around to go so wrong?
Welcome back to the Hard Landings Podcast, everybody. I'm Nick.
I'm Miranda.
And I'm Christy.
Hey.
It's been a while since we've recorded.
It's actually been quite a while.
It's been like a month.
Almost. It kind of feels like it. It's been like 3 weeks, but...
It's been a while. So you will have to forgive us because there's stuff that you guys have messaged us and things and they're like, why hasn't this been...
We were on the other side of the planet, which you can hear all about in the post episode.
Yes, you can. This one was less of a train wreck, by the way. It was still a train wreck. Don't get me wrong. It was just less of a train wreck.
I don't even know if I'd call it a train wreck, but yeah, it still had the standby saga stuff going on.
I have to file an insurance claim for this
one. Okay, yeah, there's that too.
Yeah. So catch all the fun details about that on the post episode. You got to be a $5 patron to be able to hear post episode content. So
yeah.
And then you can hear about all our other trips because let me tell you, it's pretty entertaining. The last one was a bit more entertaining than this one.
Yeah.
In regards of like travel wise.
Yes.
But you know.
Yeah.
You'll enjoy it.
Yeah. All the same. We'll tell you all about it. New place, new things.
We got some new patrons.
We actually have a handful.
Quite a few.
Yes.
I know that Kate came back. Hey, Kate.
Hello.
Hi, Kate.
Hi.
Welcome back.
Thank you for coming back. We appreciate you.
So we've got Pepian and Caitlin.
Ah. Aha. Uh-huh. Yes, that's right. I forgot about that. I saw that and I was like, the audacity of this man.
The audacity.
Also, thank you to Brian, Sukrit, Wolfgang, Adrian, and Joseph. Have you not been here before? Hi, Joseph. You've been listening to us for like since the beginning.
Joseph. Our Joseph that's like been listening forever?
Joseph!
Oh my god!
Free patron.
Oh.
That's cool.
Sorry, I don't want
to. It's cool anyway.
I don't want to sound like I don't appreciate it, but you've been listening to us for so long. I was like, oh my gosh, you can finally like listen to some other stuff that we have, but you're free patron, so you can't.
But still, it's cool.
Yeah, still thank you. That's still like thanks. Huge because people can see. I don't know, actually, can you see how many patrons we have? I don't remember.
We have 160, including the free ones and the canceled ones. If I do it just to paid active members, we have 87.
There you go. That's pretty good.
That's pretty good. Okay, so thank you for that. Newsletter went out yesterday because I had a burst of energy midday. Good for you.
Yes.
Because you wouldn't have gotten it till the end of this week otherwise.
Yeah.
Which we're recording on the 4th, by the way. So you would not have gotten it till legit the end of this week because I'm going to be so tired by the end of the week that I don't even know if I'd be able to get it done. Anyway, there's been several people actually so far that have...
Quite a few.
...answered the trivia questions. But if you feel like you want to do that, and you didn't sign up before March 1st for the newsletter, you can go on the website. It's available on the website. And you can see if you can answer any of those.
Yeah.
All right. I think that's all the housekeeping, right?
Yeah, I think so. There's not a lot else to talk about, really. I mean, unless you listen to the post episode.
Right.
Lots to talk about then.
Okay. What are we covering today, Nick?
Today, we are covering Emirates Flight 521.
Thanks to
Rich and Connor.
Huh.
I'm actually pretty sure that more people actually
maybe
signed up for this, and I just didn't put them on the list. It's a possibility.
If you recommended this one, thank you.
Thank you. Much appreciated.
Also to Kartik, because I just searched through our email for the number 521.
Mm.
And someone whose name isn't in their email.
Sorry for the dog.
There's a squeaky toy. Please ignore.
He's very excited about it.
The dog realized that some of his old toys are up here, and he just suddenly decided that that was a fun thing. It's rare that we get to talk about Emirates and accidents.
I know.
But we're going to talk about it today because this is the major one.
This one was so close to not being fatal.
Yeah.
Talk
about that too.
So close. Like, you were doing so good.
Also, here's your Miranda rage warning. I got a text from Christy, and then when I got here, she was like, you go get mad. And then we had to warn Leo. So clearly this is a bad one. So if you're wearing headphones, you might want to turn down your volume a little bit. Okay?
So I will preface with this. There are plenty of times that you could get mad if you're paying very close attention to the things I say in my story.
Okay.
But I also give away almost nothing.
Oh, okay.
So this time I get to be a little cryptic.
But I'm a very perceptive person.
But if you're paying attention
Which
to
Miranda,
the details.
Miranda may or may not do because she is cross-stitching.
If you pay attention.
I might. might miss it entirely.
Yeah. If you pay attention to the details, you will find out a couple of the areas where you will get mad.
Ex-cilantro. So,
let's get into it.
Let's crack into it. Ooh, that was a good one.
There we go. Cracked into. This accident occurred on August the 3rd of 2016. Oh, so it actually makes it relatively recent.
I feel like I heard about this. Now, do I actually remember it? No, I don't. But I think when I was putting it on the list, the episode list, that I did hear about it. Or I recognized it. I don't 100% remember because it was over a year ago. But
here's the fun thing. And even I didn't realize this until I looked at the report and everything. But the report actually came out just a little after we started the podcast.
Oh, okay. I'm surprised it hasn't been recommended sooner.
Wild, right? I know. This is a Boeing 777-31H. I know, that's a weird thing.
What's the distinction?
It's the configuration and the airline.
Yes. So it is a 777-300, and typically they take those last two digits of the 300 and change it to something else. That means it's configured specifically for this airline in a specific way.
Okay.
Most airlines, we don't really talk about this normally, but most of the time when we're doing these, when we're talking about these accidents, there is a designator like that, and I just don't use it.
Yeah.
Because I don't normally care. But in this instance, it actually does kind of matter because the 777-300 was a much more, we'll call it rare, even though it's not entirely rare, version of the 777. This is not the ER, the 777-300ER, which is the most popular version of the 777, or the 200 and 200ER, which basically look the same. This is a 300, so it has the non-raked wingtip, but it is a 300, and is also the only variant of the 300, between the 300 and the 300ER, that did not use the GE90.
That makes sense. I was wondering why Rolls-Royce was involved.
Yeah, because this isn't a GE90'd 777-300. It does mean that the performance was lower. It did not have as good of a range as the ER, the ER being extended range version of the 300. Very popular version of the 777, very popular airplane, period. But this, the original version of the 300, the 777-300, period, was not very popular. However, the few airlines that did have it, it was a high-density airplane. It was really kind of the point of it. It was not for long range, per se. It was for short and medium range operations with really high density, really high capacity for passengers. This one had the tail number Alpha-6-Echo Mike Whiskey, because it is Emirates Alpha-6. Okay, saying this name, where they originated
from.
You
know, you do real good with the Chinese names.
This is Indian.
I know.
They were flying from Thiruvananthapuram, India. That is a city all the way down in the almost the tip of India, the bottom, the south tip of India, on the west coast of India. To Dubai.
Okay.
Because it's Emirates.
We can pronounce Dubai.
Dubai is easy. I get to say that name one more time, so bear with me. The captain was male. We don't have names. There's no names. Don't know if these captains are still flying today, but they could be. He was 34 years old. At the time, he had 7,457 hours total, of which 5,123 were on the 777. Good for you, being 34 years old. The first officer was also male. Was 37 years old, so actually 3 years older, and had 7,957 hours total, so actually had exactly 500 more hours than the captain.
But how many hours on the 777?
1,292.
That's fine.
Yeah, significantly less. The flight departed Thiruvananthapuram at 10:36 a.m. local time, which, by the way, they're 5.5 hours off of UTC, and the report was in UTC time.
We've talked about that.
But thankfully, that was the only time I had to convert to 5.5 hours, and it was a pretty easy one, because then Dubai is 4 hours off of UTC. Significantly easier to figure out. The scheduled arrival time at Dubai was 12:24 p.m., so estimated flight time was to be 3 hours and 18 minutes. The flight had 282 passengers and 18 crew for a total of 300 people exactly on board.
Wow. Okay.
The captain was the pilot flying, and the first officer was the pilot monitoring for this flight. The takeoff, climb, and cruise were normal.
Everything was normal till it wasn't.
Yeah. Before descent, the crew received the weather information for Dubai and held a weather and descent briefing. 12:17 p.m., the flight descended through 16,000 feet on its way into Dubai. The flight was in contact with the approach controller for Dubai and received the ATIS information Zulu, giving them weather information and airport information. ATIS being Automated Terminal Information System, in case you needed
Unless you're new here.
Refresher?
Yeah.
It's the frequency that gives you...
All the stuff.
It's updated all the time, about every half an hour typically at most airports, sometimes more frequently if there's special
instructions. Gives you all the important stuffy stuffs.
Tells you everything. The NOTAMs, weather information, weird things about the airport.
So what if in the midst of you being the person that has to record the ATIS, you fumble over your words? Do you get to start over or are you just stuck with it?
You can re-record, and believe me, they do often, but sometimes they just go, nah, that's good enough. And then there's fumbles in there, and they really do. I've heard them plenty of times. Anyways. The crew calculated the landing speed to be 147 knots and the approach speed of 152 knots.
I suggest you remember those numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, say them again.
147 knots for landing and 152 for approach.
Okay.
So 147 plus 5 for approach, 147 being landing.
Got it. Okay.
The air traffic controller vectored the flight for the RNAV approach to runway 12 left. This is Dubai. It's also daylight hours. In general,
you can see the runway.
You can see the runway. It's pretty clear. Dubai can be a hazy place, but in general, visibility is usually pretty good.
Visibility is not an issue here.
No, visibility is not an issue. Therefore, they're doing the RNAV, which is a non-precision approach. We've talked about it in the past plenty of times. It gives them lateral and a certain amount of vertical guidance, but it does not give them precise guidance. 12:34 p.m. local time in Dubai, the landing gear was selected as down, speed brakes were armed, and the flaps were set to 30 degrees. In other words, they were set for landing. They were configured for landing.
Everything is normal.
Yep. The landing checklist was completed, and the flight was on final for runway 12 left. 2 minutes later, at 12:36 p.m., the air traffic controller cleared the flight to land, and the flight crew acknowledged. At 1,000 feet above the ground, so 1,000 feet AGL, the approach was stabilized. 12:36 p.m. in 10 seconds, the aircraft was at 930 feet above ground level when the autopilot was disengaged by the captain, but the auto throttles remained engaged as per the company operating procedures.
Okay.
12:36 p.m. in 22 seconds, the flight was at 750 feet and 153 knots. 12:36 p.m. in 40 seconds, the flight was at 450 feet above ground and 156 knots when the automated minimums call out occurred in the cockpit, so minimum. And that's when they have to decide, can I see the runway? Am I stabilized? We're landing. If not, then you're going around. They decided they were stabilized, so the captain announced landing, quote unquote, and the first officer acknowledged.
You're making a face.
The speed is bothering me, but I'm gonna
not by much right now, actually.
Yeah, it's not too high, so I was just gonna let you continue.
Yes.
You have to emphasize when you have a face because people can't see your face.
Oh, that's true, but
I can see your face. Caitlin is joining us, and she has a fruit and vegetable pouch.
A fruit and vegetable pouch. I would say that everything happens fast from here because in reality, it did. However, it takes me a little bit of time to explain things.
Okay.
So, bear with me here. All of this happened over the course of the next 2 minutes. Everything I'm about to explain, but it's going to take me a bit longer than that to explain
15 minutes to explain the 2 minutes.
Possibly longer. We'll see. I still have quite a bit of notes left for this not very long amount of time. The aircraft was at 100 feet above ground when the airspeed began increasing beyond 157 knots. 12:37 p.m. in 5 seconds, the aircraft crossed the threshold of runway 12 left at 54 feet above ground and at 159 knots. Over the next 4 seconds, the automated callouts of 50, 40, 30, 20, 10 were enunciated.
Okay.
About that fast. 12:37 p.m. and 6 seconds, the aircraft was about 100 meters past the threshold at 40 feet and the captain flared the aircraft. Over the next 5 seconds, the aircraft dropped to 7 feet above the ground, where the aircraft then floated. The auto throttle had automatically reduced to idle at 25 feet as it was designed. 12:37 p.m. in 12 seconds, the aircraft was at 5 feet above the ground, still floating, as the captain fought with the controls a bit, including a left roll input, to which he stated, oops.
Oops.
Oopsie doopsie.
We'll talk a little bit about that later on, but that wasn't necessarily consequential. However, the speed had increased to 160 knots.
Oh, no, 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 no.
Ground speed was 176 knots, but now it was decreasing briefly. Very, very, very
okay,
briefly.
Okay, but they're 5 feet above the ground.
Correct. 2 seconds later, the speed had suddenly increased to 165 knots. However, the ground speed was 172 knots. The captain cursed, then stated, quote unquote, thermals.
The does that mean?
So thermals in aviation, this is most commonly used as a term in
gliding.
Gliding, if you're a glider pilot. Thermals are actually how, as a glider pilot, you can get lift without an engine. So thermals are typically, especially, these are prominent, and it's a well-known thing, especially in desert areas like
Dubai.
Where
it's hot.
It's hot, and hot air tends to rise, right?
Yes.
So, and it will do so with a current. So there is wind. And he figures that they're floating on a tiny thermal.
And this is his home airport. So it's probably not the first time he's experienced this.
Right. So he thinks that he's gaining lift because of the thermal. In other words, just not setting down. Talk about that later on as well. The officer replied, check, quote unquote, meaning he agrees or understands.
Heard.
Neither crew at this moment said anything about the increasing airspeed, however.
Which is like the big flashing red problem in my mind. But, you know.
You're onto something. 12:37 p.m. and 16 seconds, the aircraft rolled to the left due to the winds, and the captain corrected with a right roll input, which caused the right main landing gear to touch down 1,090 meters beyond the threshold.
Not great.
Not great.
You're supposed to touch down in the first 1,000 feet.
Yeah.
Theoretically, yes. Of the runway, however, from the threshold could be a little different, but this being 1,090 meters is pretty far. However, we'll talk about that later on, too. Because there's a big asterisk here.
Nick is drawing an asterisk in the air.
Yes. Runway contact was at 161 knots, 14 knots above their reference landing speed. The spoiler lever moved partially twice toward the up position because it was armed, you know. So yes. They touched down and they did so pretty gently with the right main. And as it did so, it goes from on ground to not on ground,
right.
The sensor. And as it's changing to on ground, it's lifting the spoilers. As it's supposed to do.
Yes. But now they have asymmetry, right? Because kind spoilers of. On one wing are extended, well, the other ones aren't.
No, it will deploy all of the spoilers.
Oh.
However, but they are leaning to the right.
They've only touched down one main landing gear.
One landing gear, yes. Yeah.
And they have not deployed all the way yet. It only moved partially.
It, like, floated a little bit.
So the lever moved a little and the spoilers came up a little bit.
Yeah.
But did not fully deploy. As the aircraft continued to barely be on the ground, the captain stated, quote, go around. End quote.
That's a good idea.
He pushed the toga switch, the takeoff go-around switch,
yes.
On the left side of the throttles.
Yeah,
I like this.
I do too.
An enunciation in the cockpit then stated, quote, long landing, end quote.
Which, fun fact, is the enhanced ground proximity warning system. Apparently it does that?
777s and a lot of modern airplanes have so many modern features. It knows exactly how far past the threshold you've gone. It knows exactly when you touch down, and it's telling you now at this point, you have landed long, and you might not make it.
That's crazy.
Yep. So that's an important thing. The first officer acknowledged the captain's go-around call 1 second later after he made that call. This was followed by a second long landing enunciation.
Yes, we know.
The captain then pulled the yoke backward to pitch the nose up to 7.5 degrees to begin climbing. The aircraft had been on the ground for 6 seconds before lifting again off of the runway. The captain then called for flaps 20 degrees, as is normal for a go-around checklist. So he's doing a memory item.
It's a correct memory item.
It is a correct memory item. As the aircraft reached 47 feet above the ground, climbing again, the first officer announced positive climb. The captain then called for the gear to be raised as they passed 77 feet, and the first officer moved the handle to the up position at that time. So they're retracting the gear, flaps are moving to 20 degrees, and they're climbing. Meanwhile, while they're doing that, the tower had instructed the flight to continue flying straight ahead and climb to 4,000 feet, clearly having done a missed approach, basically. The first officer acknowledged these instructions and changed the altitude on the autopilot for the missed approach to 4,000 feet as instructed by the air traffic controller. Climbing away, gear retracting, flaps retracting, or so they thought. 12:37 p.m. in 31 seconds, the aircraft peaked at 85 feet above the ground, and then they began—
Never to return there again.
And then they began sinking. Toward the runway.
Oh.
Oh. Because they were moving just 131 knots.
Broski, how? Okay. Listen, Linda, how do they go from being entirely too fast to now entirely too slow?
We'll talk all about that in a minute. I have given you a lot of information, again, a lot of details, enough to figure out what might be going on. However, 3 seconds after it began sinking, the captain called out, quote, wind shear toga, end quote. As they sank through 67 feet above ground level. The captain, having called out wind shear toga, he's still suggesting a go-around, but now changing from missed approach to wind shear procedures is supposed to be a completely different checklist with a completely different set of procedures. 1 second later, the captain advanced the throttles manually to full throttle in order to get out of a wind shear situation.
Right.
We'll talk about that later on. Simultaneously, the enunciator called out, don't think. Don't think. It's don't sink.
But it sounds like don't think.
But in the cockpit, it always sounds like don't think because the S is very unpronounced.
Yes.
And it's always sounded that way. So where it says don't sink, don't think. It sounds like don't think. Don't think.
It's like I need one of those for my exam.
Yeah, right? The first officer called out, check speed, quote unquote, which was followed by an airspeed low caution at 128 knots. And another, don't think, warning. The captain pitched the aircraft further up to 9.2 degrees, nose up, in an unsuccessful attempt to arrest the descent. 12:37 p.m. and 38 seconds, 18 seconds after initiating the go-around, the aft fuselage impacted the runway at 124 knots.
Holy crap, they sank that much?
They sank all the way down.
Oh, they're not airborne anymore, and they never will be.
They were descending at 800 feet per second again.
Wow.
It's not good.
The initial impact was on the runway next to the November 7 taxiway intersection, as the landing gear was still transitioning to the up position, by the way. So the landing gear was still retracting as they were touching down with the back of the airplane.
Oh.
After hitting the rear of the aircraft, the airplane was still quickly descending all the way to the belly, impacting with the right engine first after the rear of the airplane. Pretty heavily because it sheared the whole engine and pylon from the wing.
Ow.
Which immediately lit a flame.
Yes.
The aircraft continued to slide along the runway, settling onto the belly. Fire began pouring from the right engine separation area, and another fire was seen coming from the bottom of the left engine, now resting on the runway as well, still sliding. The aircraft slid to a stop, finally coming to rest next to the Mike 13 taxiway, 70 meters to the right of the center line, with dense gray smoke from the right side near the fuselage and the right main landing gear bay. We'll talk about that in a minute, too. 12:39 p.m. and 4 seconds. The captain made a mayday call. No, really? Wow. To the air traffic controllers.
Oh, wait, now.
Airplanes, on the ground, completely in flames, where
I would
everybody
be able
can
to
see
that.
Oh, yeah. They watched the whole thing happen. The air traffic controllers watched the entire thing.
It took about 90 seconds for firefighting crews to show up. So, yes, everyone saw it. And they were like, oh, we should go there right now.
Yep. He made a mayday call and then informed the air traffic controller that they were going to be evacuating. Because no, really.
Yeah.
They then completed the evacuation checklist in about 1 minute. The evacuation began with the doors opening and the slides deploying. The first rescue vehicles arrived about 90 seconds after the accident. They immediately began applying extinguishing materials. All passengers and crew had evacuated within 6 minutes and 40 seconds. About 9 minutes 40 seconds after the aircraft came to rest, the center wing tank on the right wing exploded.
Oh, no.
Which caused a large section of the upper skin, so the top of the wing, the skin on the top of the wing, to detach and become airborne. It unfortunately fell to the ground and struck one of the nearby firefighters, which caused fatal injuries, causing the only death in this. All 300 passengers and crew had evacuated successfully. 21 passengers, one flight crew, and 6 cabin crew were minorly injured. 4 cabin crew were seriously injured. 1 firefighter perished, and another 5 were injured as well during the rescue operations. The airplane, of course, was completely destroyed.
Yeah.
In flames, right beside the runway in Dubai. Anything but not dramatic. Like, it was quite dramatic in the end. And it happened fast. Again, all of that happened up until the point where, like, they started evacuating. Everything from their just, like, their 100 feet above ground level to the point where they were evacuating was less than 2 minutes.
That's crazy.
Took me all that time to describe it, but it was less than 2 minutes. All those things happen. So
I don't understand why the toga power didn't work.
Let's talk about it, because that you found something interesting.
Yeah.
And something very key. But you're also still missing a couple of things.
Uh-huh. So this investigation was performed by the Air Accident Investigation Sector, or the AAIS of the UAE, with the assistance of the
NTSB.
The AAIB, Boeing, Rolls-Royce, and the Dubai Civil Aviation Authority.
That's a thing.
Both black boxes were recovered from the aircraft and,
hey.
sent to the AAIB for readout.
Yes.
The quick access recorder was also recovered, but you might or may not know this, but it is not crash-proof, so...
Not usable.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, no.
Officially, it was corrupted.
Ooh, dang.
AKA burned. Anyway, the first section of the analysis took the CVR and the FDR and put them together to recreate the flight sequence. Everything through descent was normal until the flare. At 930 feet radio altitude, or above ground, the autopilot was disconnected while the auto throttle was armed per policy. they were prepared for a tailwind landing per the information received from the tower about a minute before crossing the threshold. What they were not prepared for was the wind shear that had been experienced by a prior aircraft or the two previous go-arounds performed by recent aircraft.
Oh.
Information that ATC had just elected to not share.
Yeah, that's not great.
I left that detail out in particular because, of course, that could have been like an immediately like, oh, that was the cause. Well, kind of. Except that it wasn't entirely. But yes, there was two go-arounds because of wind shear.
Yeah.
That was reported by the aircraft, the two aircraft ahead of them, to the tower. And the tower then proceeded not to tell anybody else about it.
That's not great.
That sounds like a boo.
And then you wonder why things like this happened. Now, yeah. Again, this is not the only cause, though. Because that on its own should not cause a 777 to
crash to the ground. Two other airplanes were able to do
successfully went around.
Yeah.
Correct.
Went around and landed. Were able to do a go-around, so.
Yes, and two other aircraft also proceeded to land ahead of them.
4 seconds before passing over the threshold, the crew was aware that their tailwind had dropped from 16 knots to 13 knots, and they proceeded to cross at 54 feet radio altitude and 159 knots, which was 7 knots above their approach speed, though within stabilized approach criteria.
Mm-hmm.
100 meters beyond the threshold, they were at 40 feet radio altitude, but still at 159 knots, and the FDR recorded a pull on the control column indicating an intention to flare. Over the next 5 seconds, the nose came up to a pitch of 2.6 degrees, with the sink rate decreasing from 700 feet per minute to 350 feet per minute. Sounds like a pretty traditional flare, right?
Except one key thing.
Apparently.
Unfortunately, it doesn't quite line up with procedure, which calls for the flare to be initiated between 20 and 30 feet above ground, not 40.
So it was a little high.
I was going to say something about that.
Yes.
But I didn't know, and so I just kept my mouth shut. But
it was
high. Felt like they flared a bit early.
They did.
Starting the flare earlier than recommended most likely contributed to a float, prolonging the landing.
I was going to say something about the float, too. I was like, listen, that's but not normal.
There's one other key thing that is happening with said float.
During that time, the autothrottle had also changed from speed mode to idle mode at 25 feet radio altitude, and the speed decreased by 6 knots. When at 2 feet radio altitude, the airspeed started increasing by 12 knots over about 4 seconds, leading to an airspeed 18 knots higher than the landing reference speed of 147 knots.
Which you might have noted did not happen because of the throttle.
The crew reported not noticing the increased airspeed as they were looking outside the aircraft, per their training.
That is pretty normal.
Investigators found this 12-knot increase to be the result of horizontal wind shear, which changed the tailwind to a headwind.
Oh, no! Oh, that's why!
They were floating and gaining airspeed. I gave you all of the cues because I said they went from 160 to 165 knots airspeed, but they went from 176 knots ground to 172.
My brain was like, it sounds like they have a headwind.
They went from a tailwind to a headwind.
Dang.
And that caused the airplane to both float and increase lift.
This was likely due to the hot air coming off of the runway as well as a wind shift. The day of the accident, the runway surface was measured to be 68 degrees centigrade.
That is hot!
I did say centigrade. That means it's more than 150 degrees Fahrenheit.
Absolutely not.
It's August and in Dubai.
Absolutely not.
In the desert. A sunny day.
Canceled.
Just after noon. It's as hot as it can possibly be, basically.
Oof.
Yeah.
So, you can actually cook stuff on
that. The ambient air temperature is probably enough to cook a meal. Like.
Yeah.
At about 7 feet radio altitude, the captain said, oops, and then yes. Thermals, before making several inputs in the control column and rudder to maintain wings level and keep the aircraft centered on the runway. I approve of these actions.
He was trying his best to keep the airplane level and
on the runway,
over the runway and floating like for a good touchdown, a smooth touchdown, which to his credit. Continue.
Investigators found it a bit difficult to confirm the wind conditions at that point on the runway, as the only wind anemometer, was 300 meters forward of the threshold, and it was the only one along the touchdown zone.
Yes, it was.
It's the thing that measures wind. This wind shear had occurred more like 650 meters down the runway. That being said, though, the aircraft itself did not detect any wind shear on its radar or enhanced ground proximity warning system.
Because it wasn't designed to.
Well, it was.
However, not at that altitude. We'll talk about it later on.
And there were no cockpit enunciations related to wind shear. In fact, according to the 777 Quick Reference Handbook, which is probably ginormous.
Yes.
can't confirm.
If I recall, it's three binders.
That's Quick Reference. Yep.
So quick. This situation did not meet the criteria of wind shear as it was below the 15 knot criteria. The vertical speed never exceeded 500 feet per minute, and the pitch change was less than 5 degrees. So not technically wind shear. Technically.
Not technically, you are correct.
Regardless of the criteria, though, it still prolonged the floating of the aircraft down the runway in conjunction with the early flare.
Yep.
So I don't like that. As they continued to float, the aircraft rolled left due to the wind effect, so the captain was like, hey, we shouldn't do that, and corrected with a right control wheel input, so the right main landing gear contacted the runway, and the captain didn't like that, so he called for a go-around and pushed the toga switch a fraction of a second before the EGPWS called out long landing, which is apparently a thing it does.
Yes, it is.
Now, here's the catch. As designed, when the toga switch was hit, the auto-throttle mode remained at idle. And neither pilot noticed that it had not changed to thrust.
Even though the captain had his hand on the throttle the whole time. The throttles did not move forward, and he stated he didn't notice whether or not they moved.
So they're trying to do a go-around with no thrust.
The answer is, they didn't move. He pitched the nose up, so all it did was lose speed.
Yeah, we don't like this.
Broski, what?
We'll talk about this, but this has to do with the way the 777 is designed.
I will get there.
But wait.
Stick a needle in it. We'll come back to it.
But wait. Why? Why?
This is not where I expected her to start yelling.
Even though his hands were on the throttle.
Okay, so the FDR recorded that the main landing gear cycled between air and ground modes twice, which caused the speed brakes to partially deploy twice for less than a second each time. But the crew did not notice this. The captain called for flaps 20, 2.5 seconds after the go-around command with a pitch of 7.4 degrees. What neither pilot realized at this time was that both main landing gear were in ground mode, though the nose gear was still in the air.
Ground mode?
The gear have sensed that they are touching the ground.
There's weight on the wheels. As a matter of fact, not only did they not realize they were on the ground, the first officer in his statement to investigators said, yeah, I think we did our go-around at about 40 feet above the ground.
False.
What? No! What? Was no one looking at instruments?
No, they were not, because they thought they were flaring for a touchdown, and when they believed they had gone too far, the captain just opted to go around. To his credit, that really stabilized, smooth landing he was going for was so smooth, even he didn't notice. And they were on the ground for 6 whole seconds deploying the spoilers.
Dude!
That they then proceeded to initiate a go-around, which actually just meant pitching up and actually lifting off again, with spoilers deployed and no thrust.
Yeah,
the spoilers did drop back down after there was no weight on the gear.
So, since they had a headwind, stowed speed brakes, and flaps at 30, they did manage to become airborne, despite the lack of engine thrust. And the first officer confirmed flaps 20, once they were at 22 feet radio altitude. The airline's go-around procedure then requires both pilots to verify rotation and that engine thrust was increasing after flaps 20 selected. However, this did not have to be a verbal confirmation, and both crew members omitted this confirmation.
Mm-hmm.
They just didn't do it because they didn't have to say, yep, that's engine power. The first officer called positive climb after confirming flaps 20, as yes, indeed, they did have a positive rate of climb, but their airspeed was decreasing towards 147 knots. The captain called for gear up 4 seconds after becoming airborne, while their speed decreased to 145 knots and the pitch was now increasing to 8.4 degrees. Fun fact, I thought that sounded high. Apparently go-arounds are supposed to be like 15 degrees, so ignore me. I'm just dumb.
Yeah, they're pretty high up pitch.
Air traffic control gave them instructions for a missed approach, which the first officer read back correctly, and the aircraft reached its maximum height of a whopping 85 feet before it started to sink.
Because there was no thrust.
The first officer didn't check that the flight director was on after selecting to raise the landing gear, as required by the go-around procedure. Less than 12 and a half seconds after the toga switch was pushed, they had insufficient energy to gain height, which was aggravated by the gear doors opening. That adds drag.
Yes, it does.
This is a very bad time to have drag.
Especially when you don't have thrust.
The captain perceived the loss of speed to be wind shear, so he called out wind shear toga. And was,
the really ironic part of that is how late he was on that wind shear call.
And their sink rate increased to 500 feet per minute as they sank below 67 feet in altitude with an airspeed below 130 knots. The captain then manually advanced both thrust levers per the wind shear escape maneuver, and it was only at that point that he realized that the engines had been at idle and were not producing thrust.
Dude, your hands are on the thrust levers. How did you not know?
He was so focused on so many other things that it was just an automatic thing and he never even noticed.
So investigators then delved into the question that Miranda had asked earlier. What is the logic behind the toga switch? How does it work? What's happening?
This is something that they went very in-depth on.
Well, because the whole point, right, like, and I realize I'm not a pilot. I'm mm-hmm. not a 777 pilot at mm-hmm. that. I'm way too short to be a 777 pilot. But the thought process my brain would go through is, we need to get out of here. Yes. You press toga, everything goes all the way up, just like it's supposed to, and you get the out of there.
Yeah,
right?
So the idea is that the toga switch advances the levers.
Right.
However,
why didn't it do that?
Right.
It's designed not to as well.
Why?
So the rationale for inhibiting the toga switches is included in the guidelines of the Federal Aviation Administration of the United States, FAA, Advisory Circular 120-29-alpha, paragraph 5.14.B, which states that the ability to initiate an automatic or flight director go-around at or after touchdown is not required or appropriate.
We've talked about some other accidents where doing a go-around after touchdown isn't necessarily the right thing to do. And if you don't know how to do it exactly, it can actually put you in a more dangerous situation. Hence, the FAA's guidance was ideally not to perform a go-around once you have touchdown.
So But that's not always the case.
No.
However, we'll talk about
So when the right main landing gear touched the ground, it prevented the toga switch from advancing the throttles. What is also interesting here is that the Federal Aviation Regulations of the United States states that following disengagement of the autothrust function, a caution must be provided to each pilot. However, there is no requirement to ensure that the flight crew are informed when the autothrottle go-around mode becomes unavailable due to the inhibiting of a toga switch. So they're like, hey, you should tell the pilots when the autothrottle ain't engaged.
Turns out it wasn't in Emirates manuals.
It's also not a requirement. It's just hey, you should.
Right. No, you should 100% let them know that the toga switch is not going to... To be fair, mm-hmm. they didn't even know that they had touched the ground.
Right.
No.
So I don't know if that even would have been like a trigger thing in their brain. But
what more,
if they had known that...
Moreover, what they didn't know and what they weren't trained on, and which I will go into later, is that they were not trained that the toga switch can be inhibited.
Yeah, I would say that that's a big problem.
They didn't know that it just could not do its job sometimes, which is actually doing its job. But
you think toga switch is going to advance the throttles. That is what it is meant to do.
And then it doesn't.
Because that is a huge fault on Emirates' part.
Is a set
well,
of criteria.
Well, we'll get into it.
Yes.
That's a training thing.
Yes.
When I say we'll get into it, I mean in the next paragraph. I'm really good at this. I wrote these notes only like 3 hours ago. What's wrong with me? Investigators then analyzed the crew's actions during the go-around, and their actions actually prove how well they were trained in go-arounds. They were fast, they were efficient in doing so, and only omitted the step of ensuring that engine thrust was increasing. And that is...
was a key detail, though.
Very key.
Yes, but the fact that they omitted that shows how ingrained in them that the toga switch advances the throttles.
Yes.
Like, that's the whole thing.
Agreed.
Investigators attribute this to a reliance on the autothrottle. In reviewing the actual training that the airline gave, investigators found that the operator did utilize a training exercise where the autothrottle, autopilot, and flight directors were all set to off, and the trainee was made aware of this condition. The trainee would then be required to push the toga switches and realize it didn't do anything and perform a go-around while having to manually advance the thrust levers. So there is an exercise for that. That being said, this exercise was not intended to replicate the conditions when a toga switch is inhibited, and the crew was not trained for that specific scenario.
Nope.
The exercise was only intended for a situation where the pilots encountered autothrottle unavailability after touchdown in a general sense when it would be known ahead of time. Like, for whatever reason, earlier in the flight you found out your autothrottle weren't working or it's in op.
Yep.
Like, you just...
But then you're in a mindset where you know it's not going to work.
Exactly.
Right.
So the exercise is there, but it still is not a training for an inhibited toga switch.
My problem is that they were not told... if you have a landing gear touch the ground and have weight on it, your toga switch isn't going to work.
Right. Investigators found that neither Emirates nor Boeing thoroughly addressed training and procedure for when the toga switch would be inhibited.
Oh, shocker. Boeing? Weird.
Yeah.
It's like they can't do anything right.
They do some things right, but this was not one of them.
Investigators found the crew to be quite professional. as it turns out. There were no signs of fatigue on either the CVR nor in their flight history in the previous 28 days. The gradient and experience between the two was appropriate. It wasn't like one was a newbie and one was like about to retire, because that's not ideal. It was an appropriate gradient, and they were both very respectful to each other. They did not violate sterile cockpit policy at any point. Like, all of those things are fantastic.
I would say that this is not a crew issue. This is a training issue.
But it was still found that there was a breakdown in crew resource management during the go-around.
Yes, there was.
Well, to be fair, no one was looking at any of the things that tell them, hey, there's no increase in airspeed.
Correct. They also weren't properly performing checklists.
The first officer did not at any point express discomfort, and I use that word intentionally, did not express discomfort with the landing sequence, nor with the captain's actions or decisions. It was found that they had a shared mental model as the aircraft seemed to perform as expected during the climb of the go-around. As everything seemed to be going according to plan, they developed a confirmation bias, which was further reinforced when the first officer called out positive climb, and there was no negative feedback by the first officer to influence the captain's decision-making process. Now, why did I say the word discomfort? I was very intentional in doing so. Emirates trains with a trigger word of quote-unquote uncomfortable. If anyone in the cockpit expresses being uncomfortable, it incites an immediate reevaluation of the situation by both crew. And the captain had actually shown in his training history of experiencing tunnel vision, hearing the word uncomfortable, snapping out of it, and recovering the situation. It was in his training recorded.
And he went as far as to use the tunnel vision phrase again in how he felt about the situation on his own when recounting what happened.
But because the first officer never expressed being uncomfortable, that snapshot reevaluation never happened.
Right.
So that's what I've got on the crew and the whole actual accident sequence. Now, I don't normally cover this topic, but there was a sizable section on the firefighting services provided by the airport. The fire commander and the first two major foam vehicles, or MFVs, arrived within 90 seconds of the aircraft coming to rest and immediately started to apply fire extinguishing agent while other vehicles arrived. The fire continued on the separated number 2 engine, and video footage recorded by a passenger showed that the aft portion of engine 1 was also on fire.
Mm-hmm.
Other video footage showed thick black smoke without flames coming from the lower fuselage near the right wing root and the right main landing gear bay, and the smoke became more and more dense until it exploded.
It exploded.
When fire engine 6 and 10 arrived, they positioned close to the R4 door, which narrowed the escape path of passengers, slowed down the evacuation, and limited observation on the movement of evacuated passengers.
Awesome.
They did not slay.
No.
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 They did the opposite of slay.
Yeah. They unslayed.
So fire engine 6 and 10 are on our poo-poo list right now. So let's continue. Fire engine 6 used its main and bumper monitors to spray extinguishing agent and a sideline. I don't know what a sideline is. Maybe I should look this up. Oh, a sideline, I think, is just a hose.
That makes sense. That checks out.
And a sideline was deployed so that a firefighter could apply cooling to the right wing root and fuselage area. But these actions had no effect on the right main landing gear fire.
Yep, awesome. You heard that right.
So, fire engine 6,
useless.
Crushing it.
Absolutely useless.
When firefighters got out of fire engine 10, which is still on our poo-poo list, they also deployed a sideline and found the right main landing gear fire from closer than engine 6 was, but it was one of these firefighters that got fatally injured during the explosion. Firefighters from engine 10 were seen on video spraying agent over the top of the right wing and the R3 door. There's no fire there.
They just missed it completely.
We're doing real good here.
Do they not have eyes? I'm confused.
There's also a lot of smoke, so
there's
I'm not going to...
There's a lot of smoke, and they're having a hard time figuring out where it's come from.
They're also receiving orders from the fire commander. We'll get into that in a second. Investigators found that no fire vehicle was appropriately positioned or investigated the forward right quarter of the accident, and no detailed assessment of this area was ever conducted. So there was no change in tactics. No one looked at the front right part of the plane, for some reason.
Where the flames...
were coming from?
Actually coming from?
Were, because that was where they lost an engine.
The dense black smoke pouring from under the right wing root should have told the fire commander how the fire was moving and what the source was. You know, thick black smoke usually means fuel. And this should have led to a review of and change of tactics. And then the fire commander should have alerted the sector commander accordingly. But this opportunity was not realized because no sector commander had ever been assigned.
Isn't that nice?
Awesome.
Also, the fire commander, let's talk about him a little bit more. The fire commander's vehicle was not positioned well, so he could not assess the situation properly because he couldn't see it.
Yep.
So he's just giving
orders and he can't even see anything.
Uh-huh.
Great.
But engine 6 and 10 had ample view and could have communicated to the commander and didn't.
You think they'd be smart enough to do that? That's a bold assumption.
Nobody communicated here, basically.
The major foam vehicles were equipped with forward-looking infrared cameras. You know what that stands for? FLIR.
Yep.
FLIR.
If you watch any like ghost hunting videos, you've probably seen FLIR cameras before.
They're like heat cameras, right?
Yeah.
But thermal cameras.
FLIR is literally the brand, and that's what everyone uses. I used them when I worked in the engineering lab.
Oh, yeah.
You can get ones that connect to your phone.
Yep.
They just, like, slide into your little iPhone or Android port, and you just have a thermal camera.
That's very fancy.
FLIR is one of the most widely used on the planet infrared cameras.
So, their foam trucks have FLIR, which could have been used to detect hotspots or overheating components. But it doesn't seem like these were ever used to detect the danger of the center wing fuel tank. After the explosion in the right wing, the fire commander did change tactics to a defensive mode, but changed his attention to the safety of personnel since there was no longer an expectation of saving the aircraft. You know, the engine ripping off of it wasn't a... Anyway.
Yeah.
Cool, I agree with that decision, but he did not consider the hazard of the remaining fuel in the left wing tank, which had a potential to also explode.
Yep.
Go big boomies.
Firefighters continued to move in close proximity to the left wing without awareness of its explosion hazard. It thankfully didn't explode.
No, it did not.
But that could have been bad.
Real bad, in fact.
Investigators concluded that there was a lack of communication and no one seemed to be able to identify the landing gear fire as the source of the smoke. They believe that utilizing the FLIR cameras could have enabled diagnosis of the landing gear fire to help establish better firefighting tactics on scene. A whole 8 minutes transpired from the first appearance of the firefighting crews to the explosion.
So the whole reason to break this down a little bit, right engine sheared, big fuel fire already happening. That fire is then spreading and the right main landing gear, which had not been fully retracted when they touched down, was also dragging, thus causing a flame, a fire,
sparks,
a fire, within the bay when they did come to rest, because the airplane was on its belly. That fire then is immediately next to the wing and the tank and all of the fuel that's also spilling all over the ground.
If you ever want to hear a more horrific example of why you don't have a fire in the wheel well, look at episode 8.
Yes.
Or listen to episode 8. It was bad.
Yeah.
Nation Air.
Mm-hmm.
So this one had the fuel fire and it had a landing gear fire. And when they met, it was explosive.
So there was that section. I now recommend everyone turn down their volume. This is Miranda's favorite part. Let's discuss the passenger's behavior during evacuation.
Did you catch the detail that I said?
No, because I wasn't listening to that part.
I told you, you gotta pay attention.
So you're going to repeat that sentence because I don't think I actually say it, but mostly because I didn't write this. We're just going to read this straight from the report.
All passengers and crew had evacuated within 6 minutes and 40 seconds.
That's
for an airplane that's on fire.
That's really not great. That's really, really bad, actually. Why did it take so long?
The first
people
thing
took off the airplane, didn't they?
One of the very first things that she told me about this accident was that it took 6 minutes and 40 seconds for passengers to evacuate. And I immediately went, that's weird.
Yeah.
That was way too long.
Okay, so I am now reading verbatim from the report for the rest of this. Any interruptions by them is obviously not part of the report, but I'm going to try to stick to the report despite the yelling in my ear. So before the seatbelt sign was turned off, passengers started to stand up.
Hold on. Okay, listen here, Lindas. All right? You don't stand up. I don't care if there's everything outside, okay? Mm-hmm. And you're like, holy I gotta get off the airplane. You don't know what's going on. Sit your down.
Yep.
And buckle your seatbelt. Because what would have happened if the plane had bounced and you went boop and hit the top of your head?
What if something else hit you? What if?
What if you got hit by some steaming hot coffee somewhere? What if?
You overreacted. You went over. You opened the doors with the flames. And you're the problem.
So we're one sentence into this.
Continue.
The cabin crew, who had been instructed to attend to their stations, were prevented by passengers in the aisles from moving into the cabin addressing passengers directly. Instead, the passenger address system was used in an attempt to have the passengers remain seated. By the time the commander ordered the evacuation, 1 minute had elapsed since the aircraft had come to a stop. During this 1 minute, time was spent by the flight crew in locating the emergency checklist, which had been scattered with other loose items in the cockpit as a result of impact.
No, really.
Before the evacuation command, some passengers left their seats to retrieve their belongings from the overhead bins. These passengers blocked the aisles and passages to the exits. It was difficult for the cabin crew members to keep passengers seated before the evacuation was commanded, and by that time, the cabin had started to fill with smoke. The aircraft is visibly damaged, and the external fire had started and was visible to some passengers. Expediting the evacuation command could have attracted the attention of passengers at an early stage and reduced the opportunity for passengers to gather their belongings. A readily accessible evacuation checklist is a key factor in facilitating an expeditious evacuation command. Mm-hmm. The investigation recommends to the operator that the evacuation checklist is displayed securely in a place in the cockpit easily visible to the flight crew.
By the way, on a lot of airplanes, so they have a place to mount their kneeboard, if you will, where they can write down notes or put charts or anything that's attached to the yoke on most Boeings, right in the front. And if you remove that, the faceplate of it is an evacuation checklist.
Probably because of this.
No, they've been like that for decades.
Oh, wow.
But not all of them have it, and some of them have other checklists there too. Anyways.
The cabin crew members were challenged by a situation in which they had to decide whether to remove belongings affirmatively from passengers, which would delay the evacuation and lead to the blocking of the aisles and passageways by bulky bags, or to let the evacuation continue with some passengers carrying their belongings, which could risk damaging the slides and causing personal injuries.
Some were seen carrying multiple items off.
The removed carry-on bags filled the galleys and blocked access. Consequently, the cabin crew decided to allow passengers who were carrying the bags to evacuate with the bags.
I mean, what else are you going to do, right?
At that point, you don't have a choice, right?
They need to be able to get off, and they're being stupid, right? But they're taking their stuff off with them.
You're being dangerous, and you're causing problems for everybody.
Here,
do so.
And this happened in 2016. Mm-hmm. So my whole problem is clearly we don't have enough education on why, if there is an emergency, you leave your on the aircraft.
Agree. It's
funny you mentioned that.
Yeah, I was going to say, as a not aviation person, I would definitely grab my stuff.
Please don't.
Please don't.
I now know that.
I would.
But before.
First of all, I had to get your out for you, and I would be like, first of all, sit the down.
We have.
Second of all, you're not grabbing your stuff. It's gone.
It's
just
the
leave
whole
it.
Reason that they're trying to tell you to make sure that all your stuff is also all the way underneath the seat, because if there is an evacuation on takeoff,
people
landing,
have to get out.
They want to make sure that everybody in the row can get out like that, because they're supposed to be able to evacuate the airplane in 90 seconds. The whole thing.
Which is why over 6 minutes is very concerning.
See, I thought that was a good job. So,
oh, is, no.
No.
Yeah, I'm talking about that now.
We've talked about several accidents in the past where in 90 seconds the airplane was a bomb. So, have that 90 seconds and that's it.
The investigation believes that removing carry-on bags may increase the personal safety of the evacuee, but will increase the evacuation time and so endanger the lives of other passengers. Removing bags affirmatively may compromise the safety of cabin crew members positioned near the open exits. Regulations and the operator's procedures became ineffective when more passengers arrived at the exits with their carry-on bags. The cabin crew were left with no choice but to let passengers evacuate with their bags. The risk of damaging the two remaining usable slides was high, with potentially catastrophic consequences. An aviation safety study conducted by the
NTSB
of the United States revealed that the majority of respondents had carried their carry-on bags during evacuations. The study recommends that the FAA develop advisory material to address ways to minimize the problems associated with carry-on bags during evacuations. This investigation concludes that attempting to evacuate with carry-on baggage poses a significant threat to the lives of passengers, which is not addressed in the civil aviation regulations.
I hate to say this, but if you take your stuff off of the airplane and it took you an extra 10 seconds to do so,
you killed someone.
And people died at the end of the evacuation.
It's your fault.
I hate to say it, but yes.
It's your fault. Because you're not supposed to take anything off with you. Now, if you had taken a backpack, Backpack's a different story. You still shouldn't take it with you.
No.
But you can clutch that on the front of you. You're not going to rip open the slides.
And it's not going to be bulky and get in the way, potentially, right?
Yep. Especially if it has, like, medical equipment in it.
I'm not
valid.
Saying take you back. Right. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying if you took a backpack, I would understand more than I would taking your roller bag out of the overhead bin and chucking it down the slide with you.
Right.
That it's will still rip the slide. Yep. It's only canvas. If a zipper gets stuck in a crevice, it's ripping the slide. The slide's inflatable. It has a hole. There's no more slide no more.
One of the big things here is that your stuff is just not that important.
It's just stuff. It's replaceable.
And if
you are not replaceable.
And if you think that it's not replaceable, and I understand that there are priceless things that some people travel with, it still doesn't matter.
Don't. Why is it
It's still less important than you and the lives of those around you.
So, okay. Here's a question. Though, that I just thought about. Right? Uh-huh. Let's say you're going to another country.
Mm-hmm.
Your passport is in your backpack.
You have an embassy for a reason.
You go to the embassy, get home.
My emergency plan includes all of the embassies. So it is immediately not a problem.
Okay.
We already have that figured out. If somebody comes to me and says, hey, I don't have my passport. You know, the accident happened and they're like, I don't know where my passport is. I can't find it.
They'll figure it out.
We contact the embassy. They get it sorted for you like that. I mean, that is their job. So
because that would be my number one concern would be how do I get home if I don't have my passport?
And I get
that. We are two different people because my immediate concern is my cross stitch.
Cross stitch, which I get.
Which is also usually in my lap at landing. Yeah, I'm taking that, but that's
it. If you're holding it, that's one thing. But again, don't waste your time taking stuff. Because also, anything else, if you're thinking, oh, I got my work laptop, that's really important. Or
no, it's not.
It's not. Guess what?
It's replaceable.
They replace it.
Also, most of your stuff nowadays is stored on the cloud. Calm down.
Yes. And the airlines carry insurance for a reason.
It's just one of those things where it's not worth it. It's just not worth it. You are costing people time. You're costing people lives. Like, it's just...
You're costing people.
Like, your clothes are less important than everyone getting off the aircraft safely.
Yep.
There is no reason that a 777 in 2016 can't get fully
evacuated
in under 90 seconds. There is no reason except for the fact that people are taking their time and they don't realize how much of an issue of a situation that taking baggage off is.
So lucky that no one died in the evacuation.
How much more do you talk about with the evacuation?
I'm done.
Okay, because there was another very key thing that did happen that did hamper the evacuation that did not have to do with that.
Slides.
Yes.
They didn't deploy?
One of them did not deploy. However, a couple of them were also unusable because of the fire. But also, they were still dealing with the wind. And in every picture...
Oh, yeah, they get blown off and blown around.
In every picture, you might notice the one key detail.
The slide's not on the ground.
The slide's not even facing the right direction.
No.
Oh, zam.
Also, what they determined might have slowed down some of the evacuation is the fact that the airplane being on the belly meant that the slides were not at the ideal 20 to 35 degrees. They were only at 14 degrees, which means that people weren't really sliding down. They were scooting down, which turns out takes time. So that was another oversight.
So something we haven't talked about before, and it's not a for sure thing, but there is an additional reason that you need to read your safety information card. In the event that the slide does not deploy, there is a manual actuator for the slide.
Yes.
And it is always depicted on your safety information card.
They did determine that all of them were armed, but one of them did not deploy properly because it had actually had a damaged can on landing.
Oh.
So that wouldn't have worked here, but I need all of you as listeners of this podcast to be the more responsible ones and know how to manually deploy the slide.
There's usually a lever of some kind.
Or a string you pull.
And you pull it and it deploys the slide.
Yep.
Please, please know how to do that for the door that's closest to you.
The next closest door and the door that's farthest away from you.
Know all of them. Know the ones closest to you, maybe a little bit better, but please know all of them because that can be the difference in people's lives.
Know how to open the door, know how to open the window, know if it has to be like chucked out or if it just opens.
If it is a door that has to be removed and chucked out, please actually throw it out. Do not put it on the seats because then people cannot get to the exit. Yep. Please yeet it out the door.
It doesn't matter. Yep. If you're at a point where you have to chuck a window out of the airplane, it doesn't matter anymore. Okay? Get the hell out of there. Don't worry about keeping the window.
One of the moments where we can say take after Boeing and just let the door go.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
I'm sorry.
That was really good.
I'm not trying to be overly dramatic. Seriously, your understanding and knowledge of the safety information card could be people's lives. Please, for the love of God or whatever you hold holy, please read it and know it by heart when you're on the plane. So.
And if there's an issue, right, where you are going to end up having an evacuation of some kind, mm-hmm. which it happens like for bird strikes, things like that, where you have to evacuate even though there's no immediate danger, right? It would be a good idea to take that out.
And read it.
And read it again.
Yep.
To be like, where, if you're over water, where are all of the life jackets? Where are the infant life jackets? Which are exits, there extra boats, extra
which
rafts?
Which exits can and can't I use? Because that is very important during
water. Okay, read the safety information card because they're not all the same.
Every airplane's different. Like, I see people constantly when we're on airplanes, especially when we get on, first of all, they immediately put on their headphones, which, believe me, me too. I understand.
Yep.
But you should take them off and listen to the safety briefing. You should not fall asleep immediately because something could happen on takeoff.
Yep.
And you need to be prepared to get out. There's just so many, I mean, we're kind of tangenting a little bit and sorry, we'll move forward, but
I planned on this conversation.
You need to make sure that you know how to get the hell out of there if you need to. And if you're on a plane with me, you best be damn sure I'm pushing your out of the way.
Yeah, that's the truth.
I'm not even kidding. I won't be nice to you. I'll be like a Japanese person, which we'll get to that in the post episode. I won't even care. I will be like, you need to move. And I won't be nice to you.
Except because of a nice little old lady who you are going to help off the plane.
Unless she's getting a roller bag, I'm not.
Miranda's committing.
I'm serious. Like, I will push people out of the way. I will make sure my gets off the airplane because you're the one causing issues. I will push people out the window. I'll push people down the slide.
So another thing of note with the evacuation that they decided was like, oh yeah, that's not great. Of course there was the wind, which was blowing the slides sideways.
Every which way, yes.
Till they were tilted literally entirely sideways and basically unusable. They had also become detached. The forward left slide had become detached, and by the time the captain and first officer were trying to get out, they just decided, you know what, I'm leaving anyway. And they threw themselves down that detached slide, hence why one of them was injured.
I mean, the plane also exploded, so they could have died.
Well, to be fair,
I understand.
Same. I'm also like, you know what? I'm just going to yeet myself.
Yeah, I was going to say, I was thinking when you said they were detached, you know those videos of people landing on the giant air pillows? Mm-hmm. I would just be like,
That's kind of what they did, but that's how one of them ended up injured.
They're really far in the air. Like, a 777's really
tall.
High
Even
up.
On its belly, those doors are like 11, 12 feet up.
Like, you remember climbing the air stairs to that 777 in France? Yeah, you jump off that.
Yeah, no thanks.
Mm-mm, no, I don't.
No, I don't.
I wait for a nice-looking fireman to come help me.
The plane explodes!
The thing is that they did have exits that were usable, and they did get everybody out, but they did find that there may have been more efficient ways for the flight crew to have evacuated.
What? May have?
And you don't say.
There may have been more efficient ways to get the rest of the passengers out.
Oh, there was definitely more efficient ways. People need to stop being so nice to people.
I know.
Tell them that they're being idiots.
So you may recall earlier this year that the specific country had a plane go up in flames, and it is a society known for pushing people out of the way. Everyone got off that plane.
Yes, yes, they did.
Talk about Japan, by the way.
Yes.
Which,
they probably push people out of the way.
100%. They push people to get off the train. Of course they push people to get off the train. I mean,
a burning airplane, yes.
Okay, well, that's all I have for the first half.
Me too.
Okay, so we go and take a break and come back and do all the normal stuff.
Okay, so there were 13 15 pages of findings.
Jesus Christ.
Itemized findings. I don't think I have ever seen this many findings in one single report.
I feel like every time we find one like that, though, you're like, I don't think I've seen any.
Well, that's only because they keep getting bigger.
I don't think anyone will be, what was it, episode 6, 7?
I don't know, something like that.
7. Episode 7.
Nothing will beat that one. Yeah, episode 7.
Probably.
I have never seen a 700-page report since.
No.
Yeah, that fit. Yeah. It was in 2 volumes of 350 pages each.
Yeah, it was. This one wasn't that bad in terms of pages, but 14 pages, well, 13 pages of findings, 14 for the whole section 3, which is insane. To put it into perspective, it's normally maybe 2. Maybe 2 pages. Maybe. This is 14. They broke down the findings by crew, by crew's actions, by aircraft manufacturer, by cabin crew, by firefighters, by the FAA, by Emirates, by... They broke it down by everything. So, I'm going to go through just the very few out of all of this that I have selected, and I literally have maybe selected 10 to 15% of all of these. Maybe.
Bless.
Because also a lot of these are... They don't really get to the point. They're not... There's just a few that I feel like are like, this is what matters. The rest are like, okay, stop talking about these things. This doesn't matter anymore. Cover that in like the analysis or part section one, because that's important to you there. But here in the findings, nobody cares. So they found that the aircraft was structurally intact prior to impact and mostly remained intact after the impact.
Well, very kind of.
I would argue sort of. It was missing a whole engine.
It was missing an engine. And it was on fire and exploded, so...
I would say, yeah, maybe not. They found that the post-accident examination reports did not find any evidence of any aircraft component or system malfunction. The airplane did exactly as it was designed to the entire time.
Yeah, they just didn't know that.
Yes, that is the big thing here.
Which is a problem.
They found that the aircraft was equipped with a long landing alerting system that enunciated a long landing alert at a distance of 1,280 meters... beyond the runway 12 left threshold.
Seems a little long.
Some 92 meters further along the runway than the programmed alerted distance.
Oh, that's lovely.
So it was supposed to have alerted 92 meters earlier. The fact that it had the system already was a good thing. Don't get me wrong. But they already knew they had landed long, even though they hadn't even known that they touched down.
Right.
But even when they did, it was still a little late, 1,090 meters down the runway. So that was a whole thing, too, was like, you know, they decided to go around before they even got the long landing enunciation. However, we talked about the fact that it even has one, which is pretty incredible. But yeah, it was a whole thing. They found that the takeoff go around or the toga switches were most likely serviceable when the captain pushed the switch, because neither was there any historical aircraft maintenance records that indicated otherwise, nor was there any reported defect by UAE 521 or Emirates 521. Flight crew during the takeoff from Trivandrum, which is the name of the airport at the time. I didn't want to correct you on this until I had the information and I knew that it was in the findings. I knew that I had it highlighted. But here's the really interesting thing. They found that the toga switches are designed to become inhibited prior to touchdown. Prior to touchdown. When the aircraft radio altitude is less than 2 feet.
I didn't say it wasn't.
I know.
But listen.
We kept talking about the fact that it was... when it switched from on-ground to off-ground, and it's not. It's when the radio altimeter is 2 feet.
So when it's on-ground?
Just before it's on-ground. 2 feet above ground and 3 seconds. This mattered because they floated. Even if they had tried to do the go-around while they were floating, if they had been at 2 feet for 3 seconds or longer, it still wouldn't have worked, even without the wheels touching. They found that the toga switches are designed to become inhibited after touchdown when the aircraft radio altitude is less than 2 feet radio altitude.
After touchdown. That's the words that I relied on.
Yes, I know. The weight on wheels, wow, as it goes, that is what it is valid. And either the left or right gear, wow, indicates that the aircraft is on ground mode. They found that the toga switches are designed to be enabled when the aircraft radio altitude is more than 2 feet. So even after they had lifted, it would only work after they get 2 feet above the ground.
So it would work again after they got 2 feet off the ground.
Yes.
Yeah, but why would you press the toga button twice?
Right.
Because the first time didn't work.
They didn't know that.
Yes.
Is it the whole plane is 2 feet?
Yes.
The sensor wheels on the plane.
Right. So it has basically a sonar system,
mm-hmm,
that bounces off the ground.
That's why we say radio altimeter.
Radio altimeter. Yes. That's what it's doing. It's emitting a radio signal that's bouncing back.
Okay. And it's a bat or a dolphin.
It's a frequency.
Yes. And it knows exactly how high up it has to be for the wheels to be not touching at all.
Okay.
And so it's talking about 2 feet literally from touching anything.
Okay. Okay.
It knows that. Here's another really key thing. And I know that we talked about this very briefly in the first part, about the fact that it had wind shear detection, but it didn't indicate.
Yeah.
And there is a reason for that, and here it is.
Because there wasn't enough moisture in the air.
Nope, that's not it.
That's one of the things it said.
They found that the predictive wind shear system is inhibited from giving wind shear warning alerts below 50 feet radio altimeter.
Oh. You know, that's kind of when you want to know, though.
Yeah.
You would think, but below 50 feet, they determined it's not enough to do damage.
I still feel like it's important information.
Okay, so recently, it floated across my timeline that someone had a hard landing.
Knee slapper.
I got it.
I was waiting for it. And the landing gear went through the wing.
Yes.
So I would argue that I still want to know if there's wind shear under 50 feet.
Yes, however.
However, they do want to turn off as many annunciators as possible because it is a distraction during landing. I understand the mentality.
For one, and two, as soon as you get a wind shear alert, the immediate reaction is you have to activate the wind shear go-around procedures.
Yeah, and I would want to go around if I am encountering wind shear under 50 feet.
If they're falling from 50 feet, they're probably going to touch.
But they might float instead. It might be the opposite effect.
Correct. We're talking about this in just a second, but there's another reason why I didn't indicate, and that's because it wasn't enough to be considered wind shear.
Once an enunciating,
oral
warning.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
It literally says
I have
out loud,
announced to you that something is wrong.
Yeah, it's like, okay. sink rate, yes. Or too low, pull up.
Stop thinking.
That kind of stuff.
Yeah. Okay. But those are like super vital, critical. You want to hear those? But in the landing sequence, specifically after you've crossed over the runway threshold, they try to minimize how many enunciations there are because those are, you know, distracting. And if it is unnecessary, turn it off.
Right.
That makes sense.
This one, it would literally call out wind shear over the enunciator, telling them they have to go around.
Which I don't know. I want to know.
Here's another thing the 777 does. Are you ready? They found that the enhanced ground proximity warning system is inhibited from providing immediate wind shear warning alerts below 10 feet radio altimeter.
So, okay, 10 feet, I understand. Like, if you're encountering wind shear at 10 feet, you're either touching the ground or you're going to float a little bit.
But that's for the actual... So this is why this is important. Because in this instance, they didn't get it because of this, the EGPWS, because they were below 10 feet which it happened.
100% makes sense. The 50-foot limitation, I would argue that, like...
The 50-foot is only for predictive. If it's actively happening, the EGPWS will give it to them.
Okay, I'm not mad at them now.
It will tell them that there is a wind shear event happening. If it's below 10 feet, it won't.
That make a sense.
There's absolutely no way it would give them a warning below 10 feet, which is what happened. They got no wind shear alert.
It also wasn't a high enough magnitude of wind shear to be considered wind shear by the quick reference handbook.
Exactly. This was not enough. It was also because it was a change from an aft to a front. They weren't losing anything. They were gaining lift, which, again, it wasn't enough to be considered wind shear, first of all. And second of all, that sudden change still... because it was a positive change, not a negative change, means that the aircraft wasn't in danger of hitting the runway or having a hard impact. They found that the first officer had not received manual handling phase 2 training on a go-around initiated after touchdown with all engines operating. However, the captain had, which is interesting. So basically, one of them was trained on what to do with all engines operating and the airplane already on the ground, doing a go-around, basically. And the captain was trained on that, but the first officer wasn't.
But they also still didn't think that they were on the ground.
Right. And they still didn't know about the inhibited part for the toga switch, which is huge. As for the cabin crew, they found that the cabin crew were not trained in evacuation situations where the escape slides are affected by wind.
That's boo.
Yes. Canceled.
My sayings are catching on.
All of that to say, yeah. This was a problem because they were trying to evacuate in the wind.
It's not the first time that's happened either.
No, not at all. And the slides, particularly on the left side of the aircraft, were blown sideways where they were unusable.
And guess what? That was the less fiery side.
Yes, it was.
Yay. No, that was a boo.
That. They found that approximately 60 minutes prior to landing, the captain and the first officer completed a briefing for the approach to runway 30 left and 12 left, which included a wind shear escape maneuver briefing. So they had actually briefed on the wind shear a whole hour before they even got to the airport. Because there was no TAMS in the weather predictions that there could be wind shear.
Which I think is contributory to the fact that they did, other than, you know, the one omission, have a pretty quick go around.
They did. They did. They were doing their memory items and doing the best they could.
But so they were primed already for it, which, yes. Good.
Yes.
This could have been even worse.
Yes. They found that in the 8 minutes prior to the attempted landing of Emirates 521, two aircraft performed go-arounds from beyond the runway threshold, and two aircraft landed uneventful. So there was two go-arounds already because of wind shear, and two airplanes landed. To that end, ATC decided not to say anything about the wind shear or the two airplanes that...
Which is whack.
...went around. And it's not like every instance that an airplane goes around, the whole world needs to know that an airplane went around. But if it was because it was reported wind shear by the pilots, that needs important. To be told to everybody.
Yeah. Even if it's just one.
Yes. If you hear of wind shear, if an airplane reports wind shear, actually here in the U.S., if an airport reports wind shear to the air traffic controller, a tower controller at an airport, they are required typically for, I believe it's a 30 or 40 minute period where they are required to tell every aircraft on landing about it.
Yeah.
I mean, it makes sense. Aware,
this one aircraft experienced wind shear.
They'll tell you the aircraft type. They'll tell you that it reported wind shear, and if they have the numbers, they'll tell you what their reported loss or gain was.
I mean, as you should, right?
Yes. It's only doing your due diligence, basically, and making sure that everybody's safe. They found that passing 7 feet radio altitude, the aircraft floated over the runway, and at 2 feet radio altitude, the indicated airspeed reached 165 knots. There was a 12-knot airspeed increase in approximately 4 seconds, during which time the descent rate decreased. So the airplane floated. They found that the flight crew did not notice the increase in airspeed as they were both focused outside the aircraft, which is where they found CRM broke down. One of them should have been looking at the instruments.
Ideally, the pilot monitoring.
Yes, agreed. They found that even though the captain was not aware of the increasing airspeed, he had responded to the increasing performance and in an attempt to land, 3 times made small pitch attitude corrections to lower the nose of the aircraft. So you kept pitching down, trying to get the airplane to settle down, but it was still increasing speed.
Because that's how gravity works, turns out.
And wind. They found that 10 seconds after initiation of the flare at approximately 1,090 meters beyond the touchdown zone and at an airspeed of 161 knots, the toga switches became inhibited in accordance with the toga switch design logic when the right main landing gear contacted the runway, causing the gear to untilt, which is true. So on the 777, the landing gear actually tilts.
It's large.
It's large, well, and it tilts aft when the airplane's airborne. So it's supposed to touch down with the rear landing gear first and then gradually touch down with the middle and the front tires on the main landing gear because it's 3 axles. So it's tilted back so that the very rear axle touches down first and then it untilts. And that's what they're talking about. So it untilts to flat.
Thank you for translating that for me about 3 hours too late.
Sorry. If you look at a 777 airborne, you can see that the landing gear.
But when I saw tilt, I was like, I'm just going to gloss over that. And you know what? I did a good job regardless.
Yes. They found that the captain, who was the pilot flying, decided to fly a go-around as he was unable to land the aircraft within the runway touchdown zone.
I approve of that decision.
Yes. They found that the go-around decision was based on the perception that the aircraft would not land due to thermals and not due to a wind shear encounter.
I still approve of this decision.
For this reason, the captain elected to fly a normal go-around and not the wind shear escape maneuver. That is the only thing, is if he had flown the wind shear escape maneuver, they would have made it out.
Yeah.
Because it requires him to actually push the throttles forward.
I approve of the
forward.
Decision to perform a go-around.
Yes, but he didn't push the throttles forward manually.
Yes.
They found that when the captain initiated the go-around, his perception was that the aircraft was still airborne and had not touched down. The left toga switch was pushed approximately 2.5 seconds after the aircraft had touched down.
Which is crazy to me.
Yes.
They had no idea.
Yeah, they didn't know.
It
was so smooth.
Close to the ground they were.
Yep. They found that the flight crew did not observe that the speed brake lever had partially deployed twice during the 6 seconds the aircraft main landing gear had cycled between tilt and untilt.
Where is that lever? Is that something they should have noticed?
It's right beside the throttles. And when it's in the armed position, it's all the way forward. And it will automatically pull itself back.
So it's a large motion. Like maybe they should have noticed.
Yeah, it goes over the, I don't remember what it is. It's like the 100 degrees or the 80 degrees, depends on the throttle quadrant.
So yeah,
that visible. It moves.
Yeah, but they weren't looking at the throttles. They were looking outside.
The other thing is that the 777, like many other aircraft, on the digital displays will also show you when the spoilers are deployed.
Oh, fancy.
So they also should have noticed that. They don't talk about that, but they should have. They found that during the attempted go around, the captain said that he became focused on the go around maneuver and described his state as tunnel visioned. Quote unquote.
Agreed.
They found that the captain had stated that his right hand remained on the thrust levers during the attempted go around. After pushing the left toga switch, the captain did not recognize that there was no tactile feedback of thrust lever movement.
Which is whack.
Again, he had his hands on it the whole time and he never even noticed. They found that contrary to the FCOM, go around and missed approach procedure, this is the flight manual, after flaps 20, the captain and the co-pilot, or the first officer, omitted the steps of engine thrust verification and continued to action the procedure from the positive climb item. So they missed one very critical step that could have saved.
Was this a memorized thing?
Yes.
Yes.
This is a memory checklist.
You also have to remember that the way they were trained, there was never a situation in which
correct.
The thrust levers did not advance.
Correct. Yes, but I'm asking because, one, when you're in an emergency situation, you go into autopilot, right? And so you do what you're trained for. So I was just asking just to confirm.
Right.
Yes,
not to say
but
that,
yes, it
oh,
is.
Well, they should have noticed. But if it's always been before that the toga switch has worked, it makes sense to me why they just completely skipped over that part.
Yep. They found that no action was taken to increase engine thrust because both flight crew members were unaware that the engine thrust was not increasing automatically after the toga switch had been pushed, and neither flight crew member checked the EPR indicators, whether or not the engines had increased thrust or not. They found that the flight crew did not observe that the airspeed was decreasing as the aircraft climbed. The first officer looked down and noted positive climb. He noted that there was a positive rate of climb and that the altitude was increasing. However, he did not verify the speed at that time. They found that 4 seconds after the aircraft became airborne, passing 58 feet radio altitude, the air traffic controller communicated with the flight crew just after the captain called gear up. Why is that important? They brought that up specifically because they wanted to state that the air traffic controller was giving instructions during a critical time when this
maybe shouldn't have been.
This may have been distracting to the crew.
Yeah, that's fair.
This is a hard thing, though, because if you're not in the cockpit and you can't hear the communication that's going on, how would you know? But also, I mean, yes, they are doing the missed approach and maybe communicating with them while they're also doing all of these immediate things.
But also, there is already an in-place missed approach procedure on the charts. I don't understand why the air traffic controller had to give them additional instructions.
Yeah, he decided to change the altitude and give them the instructions to just fly straight out rather than to their missed approach point. So he decided to change the procedure on them, which actually was a problem because then the first officer immediately went to change the altitude on the autopilot rather than look at the speed. He found that as the aircraft sank at approximately 67 feet radio altitude, 3 seconds before impact, the aircraft loss of airspeed was perceived by the captain as a wind shear effect, which prompted him to call wind shear toga. They found that the captain pushed the toga switch and manually advanced both thrust levers fully forward, as per the operator's wind shear escape maneuver procedure. Only at this time did the captain realize that the engines were not producing sufficient thrust. They found that the aircraft impacted the runway 18 seconds after the go-around command, and with the landing gear transitioning to the up position. To Emirates, they found that the Emirates OMA policy required that the autothrottle be engaged for engine thrust management for all phases of flight, including approach and landing. This policy did not consider pilot actions that would be necessary during a normal go-around initiated while the toga switches were inhibited. So they literally just rely so much on the automated, again, of the autothrottle because it is really reliable and it's designed a very specific way. It's not that at any point in time this wasn't reliable, it's just that they didn't train it to the fullest extent.
Yeah. No, it would have worked if they knew how.
If they understood that
the
logic.
Why the toga didn't work.
Right. If they understood the logic behind it, then they could have known that they needed to push the throttles forward manually.
That's like my big problem is they just didn't know.
Right.
Emirates just didn't tell them that that was a possibility.
So this isn't a moment where I would say you should bash the overuse of automation. It's not necessarily the case. It's
the
lack
training.
Of training of the automation because the automation wasn't the problem. It did exactly as it was designed to.
They just didn't know what it was designed to.
Right. And that's kind of what they're pointing out here. They found that Emirates' training program for the Boeing 777 was based on the aircraft manufacturer and the FAA-approved training program, which did not include the toga inhibition logic.
Therefore, means it's not the airline's training's fault.
It's Boeing. Boeing and the FAA, by the way.
Because the FAA has to approve that.
Yes. They found that in developing the training for a go-around after touchdown, as referenced in the operator's Boeing 777 training manual, scenarios for a go-around in automatic flight and in manual flight with the autothrottle armed and active were not considered. The toga switches inhibit logic was also not considered, and as a result was not part of the training syllabus, needless to say. They found that Emirates training and operational systems did not identify hazards associated with normal go-arounds performed close to the runway or after touchdown. So their training program didn't even really consider what to do with a training after touchdown or close to the runway. It was always in a different phase. They found that at 12:30 p.m., a warning of moderate wind shear for all runways was broadcast on the ATIS Information Zulu, which they did have, 37 minutes before Emirates 521 attempted to land. This is another reason why they planned for wind shear, because they had already received this in the ATIS. They found that except for one aircraft, the next four aircraft, including Emirates 521, that were cleared to land by the tower before the accident, were not informed that there was a pilot report of wind shear on short final during the landing. Again, big mistake still. They found that two aircraft performed a missed approach after crossing the threshold. However, the next three aircraft, including Emirates 521, were not informed by the tower about the go-arounds. Neither was the reason for the go-arounds reported to air traffic control, nor was it reported by the flight crews. So they went around and nobody ever said anything, which is a problem in and of itself. If you go around and you have a good reason for it, like you say it was wind shear, you should report that.
Yep.
They found that a number of essential information was not communicated to Emirates 521 flight crew. These include missed approaches, the reported wind shear on short final by flight IAW-123, doesn't matter, the continued gusting and wind shear conditions, and the wind shift at runway 12 left threshold from headwind to tailwind starting from 12:29 p.m. They found that at Dubai, wind shear due to the onset of the sea breeze is a known weather phenomenon. Because the airport is so close to the water. It's not that close, but it's close enough. They found that except for the anemometers fitted at locations close to the threshold of runway 12 left and 12 right, and the wind profiler, the airport was not equipped with a low-level wind shear system to detect localized wind shear near the runways. So it could detect...
If it's such a well-known phenomenon, why don't they have...
Exactly. And the amazing thing is that this airport is unbelievably modern. How modern? At night, this is something that almost no other airport on the planet does. At night, when an airplane is given taxi instructions and the air traffic controller actually puts that into the system, it actually lights up a green path for the airplane.
And they don't have a low-level wind shear alert system.
Yep, on how to get there. So they don't even need to follow me or like to look at charts. They can just follow the green lights. It tells them which direction to go.
And they don't have a low-level wind shear alert system.
Correct. They didn't at the time. That has likely very much changed. I think it's in the change section, but I couldn't find it.
Okay.
There's a whole section on changes.
Emirates specifically liaised with the airport in order to install a low-level wind shear alert system.
I'm sure they did. It's all the same government anyways. They found that at Dubai, the aerodrome weather office had no ability to create, issue, or distribute automated wind shear alerts. The weather office at the airport literally was like, they can't do anything about wind shear. They know it exists, but they're not allowed to do anything about it.
They have a system now.
Yeah.
How extensive is it? No idea.
You found that no dynamic risk assessment was conducted and sideline firefighters were moving very close to fuel tanks where there was a potential explosion hazard. Crew managers did not communicate details of the firefighting actions to the fire commander. Just a lack of communication overall and people in the wrong place. They found that the fire from the retracted right landing gear continuously heated the right side of the center wing fuel tank. They found that the resulting fuel vapor explosion tore a large section of the upper right wing skin away from the wing, fatally injuring one firefighter. They found that the most recent airport emergency exercise carried out in June 2015 revealed deficiencies that were repeated during the accident response. That to me is key. If you found problems during your emergency response the year prior, it was over a year prior, you should have been able to fix those deficiencies. But then the exact same problem showed up during the accident. Which tells me that they didn't do enough. They found that some passengers disregarded cabin crew member instructions and left their seats while the seatbelt sign was still illuminated. They found that during the evacuation, smoke filled the center cabin, separating the forward evacuation process from the evacuation in the aft cabin. So there was actually so much smoke over the wing area in the cabin that the evacuations were totally separate processes forward of that and behind that. They found that for most of the evacuation, only one exit was usable in the forward cabin, while two exits were usable in the aft cabin. Five slides were affected by wind, and these exits were permanently or temporarily blocked. They found that the cabin crew attempted to convince passengers to leave their carry-on baggage behind, but a number of passengers evacuated with one or more pieces of carry-on baggage, which prolonged the evacuation. No, really. Again, just don't bring your stuff with.
Please.
Please.
Please leave it on the aircraft.
They found that out of 282 passengers, 69% evacuated the aircraft from usable exits on the right side, where firefighting activities were ongoing. The remaining passengers evacuated from the L5 door, the back left door. But 69, which means majority of the passengers and crew exited on the right side where the flames were with the firefighting activities and the extinguishing happening. Not great. Not great.
So I was trying to research how big their low-level wind shear alert system is, which, fun fact, is not an easy answer to find. Still didn't find the answer. But I did find out that they have an automated weather observation system.
An AWOS?
And they had it installed in 99.
Mm-hmm. A lot of airports, if they don't have an ATIS, they have an AWOS, which you can actually get an AWOS at a lot of ATIS airports as well, too, to find out what it is. You can actually call. There's phone numbers for AWOS. You can call and listen to them. I should pull up
the Dubai system is a large running combination of two central data units that provide maximum reliability. Do they have a low-level wind shear alert system?
I should pull up an AWOS sometime and we should listen to it. They found that the passenger evacuation lasted 6 minutes 40 seconds. The captain and the senior cabin crew member were still on board the aircraft at the time of the explosion in the center wing fuel tank, and they evacuated from the L1 door jumping onto the detached escape slide. The broken slide. They found that the civil aviation regulations did not require an item in the passenger briefings for passengers to leave behind their carry-on baggage. So on Emirates and in Dubai, there was no regulations saying that they had to tell people to leave their stuff behind.
Oh, well, they should.
Yeah, that's insane.
Obviously, if this
The FAA and most countries always have that in their safety briefings to passengers where they say, please leave your items behind, your stuff behind, your belongings. And that's all I'm doing of the findings. Again, there were an insane amount more. I just skipped so many. It felt like I did a lot, but I skipped so many. So anyways.
Okay. The causes. The AirX investigation sector determines that the causes of the accident are A, during the attempted go-around, except for the last 3 seconds prior to impact, both engine thrust levers and therefore engine thrust remained at idle. Consequently, the aircraft's energy state was insufficient to sustain flight. B, the flight crew did not effectively scan and monitor the primary flight instrumentation parameters during the landing and the attempted go-around. C, the flight crew were unaware that the autothrottle had not responded to move the engine thrust levers to the toga position after the commander pushed the toga switch at the initiation of the go-around and missed approach procedure. D, the flight crew did not take corrective action to increase engine thrust because they omitted the engine thrust verification steps of the go-around and missed approach procedure. Contributing factors. The investigation determines that the following were contributory factors. Flight crew unable to land within the touchdown zone during the attempted tailwind landing because of an early flare initiation and increased airspeed due to a shift in wind direction. When the commander decided to fly a go-around, his perception was that they were still airborne. He then expected that the autothrottle would respond to the toga switch and automatically manage the engine thrust. Based on their inaccurate situational awareness of the aircraft state and situational stress related to the increased workload involved in flying, they were unaware that the aircraft's main gear had touched down, which caused the toga switches to become inhibited. I would like to reinstitute that it was because they touched down.
Yes. Yes, they did.
The flight crew's reliance on automation and lack of training in flying go-arounds from close to the runway surface with the toga switches inhibited significantly affected their performance in a critical phase of flight. They did not monitor the flight mode enunciation changes after the toga switch was pushed because the changes are not required to be announced. The callouts were not included in the go-around and missed approach procedure, and callouts of FMA changes were not included in the training. The operator's OMA policy required the use of the autothrottle for engine thrust management for all phases of flight. This policy did not consider pilot actions that would be necessary during a go-around initiated while the autothrottle was armed and active and the toga switches were inhibited. The missed approach procedure did not contain steps for verbal verification callouts of engine thrust state. The aircraft systems as designed did not alert the crew that the toga switches were inhibited. The aircraft systems as designed did not alert the crew of the inconsistency between the aircraft configuration and the thrust setting. Air traffic control did not pass essential information about wind shear reported by the preceding crews to the accident crew. This could have affected their decision making during approach and landing, and they were deprived of this critical information. The modification of go-around procedure by air traffic control 4 seconds after the aircraft became airborne coincided with the landing gear selection to up. This added to their workload. And that is it. I abbreviated some of them because that was a lot.
Yes, you did. That's okay. So they had a section on what changed. I'm just going to do a few of these. And then
they got a low-level wind shear alert system.
Yeah, and then we're going to do a few of the recommendations. Safety actions taken by Emirates. Training for go-around after touchdown. They actually figured out how to do that training program because, you know, that needed to happen. They did inclusion of information relating to the toga switch inhibit logics in various training modules. So they actually trained the inhibit logic. Simulations of the accident flight wind effect in the simulator to expose flight crews to the effects of a performance increasing shear. So when the wind shear actually adds to your airspeed and lift, and they train on this specific flight. Safety actions taken by the Dubai Air Navigation Services. So they conducted a review of go-arounds at Dubai and undertook work to improve the management of go-arounds by the air traffic controllers. DANZ has included appropriate information and guidance in the air traffic services operational and training manuals and added modules in the air traffic controllers' annual contingency training program. So it requires them to understand how to report wind shear and how important that is. Taken by the Dubai Airport, firefighters and fire command training systems. This was one of the things that they took on. They undertook a review and changes to their training system for firefighters, addressed to Emirates for recommendations. They recommended to enhance the normal go-around and missed approach training standards, which should include simulated scenarios for a normal go-around initiated close to the runway and after touchdown when the takeoff go-around switches are inhibited. This should also include information on engine response time to achieve go-around thrust. They recommended enhancing training standards regarding toga switch inhibiting so that pilots are aware of the effect on FMA enunciations and the flight director and the availability of the auto throttle after the aircraft becomes airborne during a go-around. They also recommended implementing changes to crew resource management training, taking into consideration the lessons of Emirates 521. They recommended including in-cabin training evacuation scenarios where the escape slides are affected by wind. That seems important to me, like not training on what to do when there's wind affecting your slides, because that's a very real possibility. It's happened on several accidents we've talked about.
Sometime in the next several months, we are going to be interviewing someone who went through flight attendant training twice.
Mm-hmm.
And we can ask him what kind of training he got on that.
Yes. They recommended for quick access, ensure that the evacuation checklist is displayed securely in a position in the cockpit easily visible to the flight crew. To the Dubai Air Navigation System, or services, sorry. They recommended implementing procedures and guidance that would limit the air traffic controller to the maximum extent from distracting the flight crew by issuing instructions modifying the published missed approach procedures in case of a missed approach. Just don't do it. Just let them fly the missed approach that they have published, unless, of course, it's going to put them in danger, but wait to do so until you can tell that they're safely, you know, configured and on the move, because they were not yet. They recommended enhancing the procedures in air traffic controllers training so that whenever wind shear warnings are in effect at an aerodrome, an airport, essential safety information such as go-arounds, long or deep landings, when reported, wind gust and wind shift is always transmitted to the flight crew at an appropriate time during the approach. Safety recommendations addressed to the Dubai airports. They recommended enhancing the training for the airport rescue and firefighting services personnel to enable them to identify confined heat sources based on indicators and smoke traces. This training should enable the fire commander to understand the fire dynamics and determine the appropriate tactics depending on the site circumstances and considering utilization of unique capabilities of the fire vehicles. This should be supported by sufficient training in incident command. They recommended enhancing the ARFFS personnel practical training exercises by including new scenarios based on appropriate simulated techniques that challenge the firefighters, crew managers, and fire commanders to assess fire dynamics and develop tactics. The scenario should replicate the circumstances of actual accidents with various aircraft states. Different weather and environmental conditions should also be considered, like wind. To Boeing! They recommended enhancing the Boeing 777 crew alerting system to include aircraft configuration inconsistencies when a go-around maneuver is commanded and the engine thrust is insufficient for the maneuver. So if you've pushed the toga switch and the throttles don't advance, or you're pitching up and the aircraft recognizes that you're trying to go around, it should have something that tells the pilots that you're not configured for a go-around.
Yep.
Whether or not they've done that, to be honest, I don't know. And that's going to be a hard one to figure out.
Yeah, get good, Boeing.
Yeah. They recommended including the Boeing 777 go-around and missed approach procedures and amend the FCOM and FCTM accordingly. Requirements for the pilot flying to give call-outs for thrust setting with a verbal verification of thrust increase being made by the pilot monitoring. In addition, emphasis should be made on the importance of guarding the thrust levers. The existing thrust setting call-out in the takeoff procedure could be referred to. So how they already use procedures for takeoff, they could use that in a go-around procedure for changing thrust. and verifying. They recommended conducting a safety study to determine the benefits of developing a common procedure for the Boeing 777 normal go-around and missed approach. This procedure should consider manual advancement of the thrust levers at low altitude and after touchdown, and the requirements for go-around after touchdown, including flap position, aircraft rotation speed, and crew awareness of associated warning alert messages. To the FAA, they recommended performing a safety study in consultation with the aircraft manufacturer for the purpose of enhancing the Boeing 777 wind shear alerting system. This study should encompass both predictive and immediate wind shear systems. And that's it. That's all I'm covering.
Sweet Jesus.
There were a lot more. I literally did maybe a third, maybe not even a quarter of the recommendations, too. Jesus. They were very long-winded.
Yeah, no duh.
Well, the funny thing is that each one of those was pretty short compared to some of the ones we've read in the past. They just had a lot of them. A lot of them.
All right. Well, that was Emirates
521.
521. I was going to say 352.
No. Not even close.
Thanks for listening, people. Some of you have put in recommendations. I've seen them. I have not put them in yet.
You may recall we were on vacation.
Yes. We're right. Catching up.
I usually wait for a little while and then I'll put all of them in, mm-hmm. in a big chunk. So yes.
It's fun to see where we end up.
Please be patient. It's coming. Okay. If you are like, wow, I'd love to hear about your trip, you need to be a patron. So go ahead and check us out on patreon.com, or there's information on our website that you can also look into if you so wish.
Yes.
And I think that's it. I mean, we appreciate you. Thank you. Keep telling your friends.
Keep passing it along.
Keep passing it along.
Liking, subscribing, sharing, sending.
Hitting that like button.
Smashing that like button.
Like, follow, and subscribe.
That follow button.
All right. Thank you so much for listening. We do appreciate it. We hope you have a safe and healthy week, and we'll catch you all next week.
Keep your speed up.
Please like and follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Hard Landings Podcast and on Twitter at Hard Landings Pod.
Subscribe and leave a 5-star review on the platform you are using to listen.
If you would like to see photos and sources for this episode, please visit us at hardlandingspodcast.com, where you can also leave us feedback and ask questions.
This episode was researched and written by Nick and Christy.
Our theme song was written by Miranda and performed by all three of us plus Leo.
And our logo is by Naomi.
Thanks for listening. Catch you next time.